You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
The U. The new Miami. The new Miami. The new Miami. Surge, surge. The new Miami. The new Miami. The new Miami. Surge, surge.
It's a cane thing when we walk through. With the U ain't no bark, dude. Straight dog when we bring the fight. Ain't scared of no bright.
Welcome back to Wide Right, brought to you by DirecTV Stream. Get your TV together with the best of live and on demand. Learn more at DirecTV.com. I'm Manny Navarro, Miami Hurricanes beat writer. It is Tuesday, September 21st, 2021. And tonight I'm talking about a 1-2 Miami Hurricanes football team following Saturday's 38-17 loss to Michigan State at home. Fans are deflated. People are upset. They want Manny Diaz fired. They want Blake James fired. It is chaos in Coral Gables once again. After
anarchy.
Just 27 games under Manny Diaz. And that voice, of course, is Carlos Lito, who is co-hosting with me again on the show. Carlos, of course, from the MIA All Day podcast, my co-host as well at Onside Radio before when we were doing shows for Onside Radio. Carlos, I know this has to hurt you as a fan, but comically, I want to know, what did you do during the fourth quarter as Michigan State was putting Miami away? Were you taking shots with every Michigan State touchdown? What were you sort of doing Saturday as this thing was dwindling?
Listen, man, if I would have taken a shot every time Michigan State scored in that fourth quarter, I would have blacked out and I probably would have gotten alcohol poisoning. So I did not do that, thankfully. What I did do was when it got to 31-17, I threw my hat across my backyard, jumped in my pool with my clothes on, and told everybody not to talk to me for the next hour.
And how did that work out? Did they give you the silent treatment as you asked, or how were you treated?
My daughter told me, hey, can we play some basketball in the pool? And I was like, all right, cool. Never mind.
You got over it quickly then.
I got over it quickly. You know how it is with girls, man. When your daughter comes at you and asks you something, your anger at whatever it is that's going on around you melts away.
It's been an interesting, I want to say, 72 hours since, you know, this game ended. And, you know, everybody on social media has basically just decided that it's time for Manny Diaz to be fired. And, you know, I did a story. I wrote a column on Saturday after the game when I got home about how in some ways I feel like, you know, part of what's happened here to Miami these last five games where they've basically just shit the bed, right? There's no other way to describe it, going 1-4. I feel like in a lot of ways, Manny Diaz set himself up for this. And the only reason I'm starting with this sort of angle, Carlos, is it's hard to be a head coach and it's hard to be a first-time head coach in a pressure cooker like Miami. And the reason I say Manny set himself up for this is, you know, he's sort of made De'Aaron King, you know, Kobe Bryant, Allen Iverson, Michael Jordan. He kind of put everything on De'Aaron's shoulders. And when you do that, I think in some ways you force the rest of the team to sort of look at that guy to be the savior for everything. And that's what I saw on the sideline in the second half of that game. Miami was down 17-7. De'Aaron goes to the locker room to get that shoulder looked at. And you could see it on the side. All the players, is he going to get back in time? What are we going to do? What's happening? You know, it was like, and I was looking through my binoculars from the press box, like, this is comical to me. Like, yes, De'Aaron King is your best player, but at what point did he become the be-all end-all of hope for this team? And I think in a lot of ways, I don't want to say that poisoned the well for Miami, but I certainly think there are a lot of players that emotionally, if De'Aaron and the offense aren't rolling, they're not playing well. And I think it kind of rubs off on everybody else. Am I seeing too much into this?
You're right. Because as a fan, it happened to me too. When I saw him go to the locker room, I told my wife, okay, that's it. It's over. The game's done. That guy is the offense. Because you know why? Last year, we got so used to him being the entire offense and making the plays down the stretch to get those wins that we got last year, those one possession wins, 1-2-3 point wins against these teams. And when he went out against Oklahoma State, you felt it. I mean, Nikosi Perry played well in the bowl game, but you feel like if De'Aaron King was in that game, they win that bowl game. So it's become this thing where he's been built up to be not only a central focus of the offense, but the central focus of the team, especially with the campaign of let's run it back. I'm coming back for a reason. We got all these guys coming back. He's going to lead the charge. And you even saw it in the game. Like, he was trying to do it all, even to his detriment, to his physical detriment. That play where he scrambles in the second half and dives for a first down on fourth and one or fourth and two and gets just popped. And you could see him grimacing like he was already hurt. And he continues to put his body on the line for this team. And it's a shame that nobody else is giving that kind of effort. I mean, I see them playing hard, but they're not playing De'Aaron King level hard. You know what I mean? And it's sad because this guy is literally giving up his body and his well-being to try and push this team forward. And other guys are not responding.
Yeah, and I think, look, it's easy right now to get caught up in the 30 missed tackles and you know, all these other stats, the fact the offense is, you know, last in scoring in the ACC, you know, the yardage. I think they're 12th out of the 14 teams in the ACC. Like, we can get caught up in all this, but I think fundamentally when you build a team from the ground up and you sort of anoint a leader, if that leader is not playing his best, or he's coming back from an injury 8 months removed from major knee surgery, and he's just not as good as you need him to be, I think it has a negative effect on everybody else. And I guess that's why, I mean, look, maybe again, it's looking at things too deeply, right? Trying to analyze it too deeply. But I think, you know, when you think about this 5-game stretch, I mean, Derek didn't play well against North Carolina either. And then he gets hurt against, you know, Oklahoma yep. State in the bowl game. He didn't play well in the beginning of that game, and they fell behind 21-0. You know, Alabama right off the gate, you know, he's getting popped. When we sit here a year from now, 2 years from now, we look back at the Manny Diaz era and say, well, what went wrong? Where did things break? I feel like this is going to be a much bigger story. I feel like I'm the only one talking about this too. Nobody else is really writing about this or talking about this. But I feel like it's an important issue because at some point you're only as good as your best player if you make the entire team about that. And I think that's what Manny Diaz has done. And you know, if things are going to get back on track, man, they need somebody else to step up. Somebody messaged me tonight who says that they think De'Aaron might be done for the season.
I wouldn't be surprised.
And you know, the shoulder separation or whatever, however bad the grade is. He wasn't at practice today. You know, I for sure he's not going to play this week. I can't see any way, shape, or form that you would play that guy this week against Central Connecticut State. But I think tomorrow and in the days ahead, we're going to be talking about what the hell do you do now for the rest of the season? Because yes, everybody wants to fire the coach. They want to fire the athletic director and hire Mario Cristobal right now to come in and fix everything. But that's living in an entirely different world. And we'll get to those subjects in a second. But I think right now it's a good time to talk about how do you fix this the short term if De'Aaron comes back, and then if he doesn't come back. Let's assume for a second he does come back a month from now.
Right. It's not going to be anytime soon, I don't think.
Let's just assume it's a month, 2 weeks, whatever. He's back for the second half of the season. Let's just conservatively say he's back for the second half of the season. Can Miami survive beating Virginia at home, North Carolina on the road, and potentially Pittsburgh on the road? Those three big ACC games. Could Miami survive that without De'Aaron King in your mind?
Okay, so I think one of the things we saw Saturday against Michigan State is reminded me a little bit of the Brock Berlin situation down here. Larry Coker tried as hard as he could to make Brock Berlin play under center and play in a pro-style offense. And Brock Berlin just wasn't comfortable doing that as much as he tried. And until they got him in the shotgun, every time they did, usually in late game situations against Florida, Louisville, all these teams, he started to light people up. And finally they realized, maybe, just maybe, we should do what makes Brock comfortable so we could score points. I think on Saturday what you saw was De'Aaron King hasn't been comfortable running RPOs. He hasn't been great at making those decisions. He hasn't been comfortable running zone read. He never ran it at Houston. But what he did do was drop back, swing the ball over the field in the spread, and also run play action, normal play action, not RPOs or zone reads, and tear teams apart that way, and then use his legs when he needed to. And we saw him do that. I think Rhett Lashley did a good job of going away from the RPOs and try to make De'Aaron comfortable, and it started to work, although De'Aaron made some bad decisions later in the game. But still, he had opportunities to make plays. And I think Now, if D'Eriq is out for a significant period of time, whether it be 2, 3, 4, 5 weeks, Rhett Lashley is going to have to tailor the offense to Tyler Van Dyke if it's going to be him. And if he doesn't step up, Jake Garcia if it's going to be him. Whoever it is, he's going to have to tailor that offense to the skills that he has at quarterback and the weapons that he has around him. I think if D'Eriq's out for a little while, it may actually force Lashley to be more creative on offense and scheme up more than just relying on D'Eriq King every damn play. Because it's impossible to expect D'Eriq to last a full season when he was, what, first in the team in carries against App State? And again, this week he had about the same amount of carries as Cam. I mean, it's impossible to think he would last a season that way.
Yeah, they're not even trying to run the ball. And I think, you know, to a certain extent, that's been because of the issues that they've had on the offensive line, right? There's not enough physicality. Those guys aren't getting their hands on guys and pushing them out of the way and creating running lanes. I think the other part of it is Cam Harris. This isn't the system built for him, right? These delayed handoffs where he's getting the ball and defensive linemen are already in his face. It's going to be really interesting to me when we find out tomorrow how long D'Eriq is out or what the situation is with him, how Rhett Lashley sort of redoes this offense, because Tyler Van Dyke can't run the same system D'Eriq King was trying to run. Jake Garcia can't do it. The RPO is not going to work with those guys. They need to be in a shotgun offense where they do hand the ball off and it's productive sort of runs. And you know, Rhett did talk about that this week about, you know, maybe there has to be more designed runs. He was asked about it, certainly. But, you know, the way they're playing right now through these first three games where everything falls on D'Eriq's shoulders, it hasn't been working out. And had he not been hurt, I mean, that's part of the reason I wrote that column is at what point do you change your philosophy when you just keep running the same stuff and it ain't happening?
Absolutely. And I think, listen, I don't necessarily know that Tyler Van Dyke and Jake Garcia can't run RPOs, because remember, there's a difference between RPOs and zone read offense, right? When you're doing a zone read, you're basically reading a backside defensive end or a frontside defensive end, and the quarterback is either giving or pulling based on what that person does or whoever it is you're reading. With an RPO, it's a run pass option, meaning you can hand it off or you could throw it, and you're basically looking at two levels of defense. You're first looking at a defensive lineman and then a player at the second level if you pull that ball to throw it either on a slant or whatever the case may be. So it's a multiple read thing. So if these guys ran that in high school, it doesn't necessarily mean they have to be a mobile quarterback, a guy that runs a lot, but it has to be multiple decisions that they make and reading the defense in that sense. Are they comfortable doing it? I don't know.
I'm all for fewer decisions for these guys.
Right. I mean, and I think Lashley's on point with having more designed runs, because the problem with RPOs is your offensive linemen are essentially not run blocking per se. They're stepping forward almost as a half run block and then waiting to see what happens. With a designed run, these guys know exactly what they got to do. Okay, I'm pulling here. I've got this guy when I come around. I kick out the first guy, or I loop around and get the linebacker, whatever the case may be. And they've got their assignments ingrained in their head, and they are run blocking in their mind. So that's a different mentality when you're running the ball. And I think that may help. Also, I'm tired of seeing Cam Harris go down on first contact. This guy is the only dude I've seen in my life that looks like a bowling ball, is built like a truck. And if somebody breathes on him, he goes down automatically. This guy reminds me of this old saying that an old friend of mine, George Zagalas, who coaches at Archbishop Carroll, used to say all the time, looks like Tarzan, plays like Jane.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Well, it's interesting because we've made such a big fuss about the missed tackles, and rightly so. They're the worst tackling team in the country right now with 66 missed tackles in three games, a 22-game average. And we're going to get to what you want to get to later when we break down the defense a little bit more. But if you look at Miami, you know, from the way that they're running the ball and, you know, in terms of making guys miss, 11 missed tackles forced. I mean, that's literally, you got 66 missed tackles. And this is just from the running game.
66, I mean, Walker had more than that on Saturday, didn't he?
He had 20. Walker had 20 missed tackles. Right now in the run game, Cameron Harris has 5 missed tackles forced. De'Eriq King has 5 and Don Chaney Jr. has 1. I'm going to look at receiver here just for a second. I'm going to try to pull up these grades on Pro Football Focus. Just, I know this is what Kelvin Harris hates. He doesn't want us talking about Pro Football Focus because he hates them so much.
He hates numbers. He hates analytics. But I mentioned on my podcast before the Michigan State game that one of the things they needed to do was use the passing game as part of the run game, take what the defense gives them, and the receivers needed to get yards after the catch, what they hadn't done all season. Ramble did a great job of that in the first half, and then it went away.
9 missed tackles forced by Miami's receivers. So 2 for Cameron Harris, receiving, 5 rushing. He's got 7 of the 20 missed tackles. Keyshawn Smith has 2 missed tackles forced, and Mike Harley has 2 missed tackles forced. So you talk about, you know, Miami creating those moves, right, to get down the field. You throw the ball underneath. You run the ball. You got to get to that second and third level, right, for those explosive plays. Well, none of these guys are making guys miss. It's the facts. It's what's out there. And meanwhile, the other guys on defense, 66 missed tackles. I mean, it's mind-boggling how bad they've played. They're lucky to be 1-2. If Chase Bryce was accurate, Appalachian State's quarterback, they'd be 0-3 right now. All right, Carlos, look, we're going to get back to the offense and the defense and break things down a little bit more, but everybody wants to talk about the future. What are they going to do with Manny Diaz? Are they going to fire him in the middle of the season? Are they going to wait till the end of the year? He's got 2 years left on his contract. You also have everybody wanting to get rid of athletic director Blake James. Barry Jackson of the Miami Herald, my former colleague, wrote a story where he interviewed a bunch of trustees and people around the program, citing them as anonymous sources. And essentially, it's everything that I've been saying for years about Miami's program. Number one, they're not going to spend a lot of money on a head coach to replace Manny Diaz, because if you fire him now, you got to pay him $8 million to go away, right? He's got $4 million per year with his job. And then if you're going to go out and bring in a Mario Cristobal, you got to, you know, pay him off, do his buyout, which is, I think, over, $9 million, something like that. So that's 17. Then you got to pay him probably $7 or $8 million a year to get him, you know, happy, and then pay his assist. I mean, you could sit here and do the math. Miami has never been a program that spends money on football. And that's a fact. Okay. They just don't. This is a program that used football to get itself into the big leagues in the ACC with all the other academic institutions. They make all their money on TV revenue and what the ACC shares with them as a Power Five member. And yes, do they have donors? Yes, the Damaris. There's a lot of people who have given this school money, but there's no oil salesman, right?
This ain't Texas. Like the one guy, I have this one friend who keeps telling me, all right, that's it. We got to fire Manny. The Lennar people are going to put all his money in, and they're going to throw him. That's a big donor. And I was like, bro, why would Lennar throw money in a black hole? Why would they do this? Like, do you think Lennar, just because they make all this money, the people that run Lennar are sitting there with $100 bills burning in their pockets saying, I need to pony up and fire this coach and give all this money to the next one. I need to pay this buyout and make sure this happens. Yeah, they love the Hurricanes, but they love money more.
Yep. And here's a quote from a UM official to Barry Jackson of the Miami Herald. Gifts at UM are made for research and the medical school and the music school and facilities. We don't have donors who contribute to change the culture of the football program or make a transformational commitment to land an elite coach. That tells you all. I mean, again, I've been saying this for years, but now Barry Jackson puts out this report and it's in clear writing for you. So whatever ideas you have in your head of somebody stepping forward, unless somebody like Marcus Lemonis, who is on the board of trustees and he owns the Camping World Sports, unless a guy like him or some
love
billionaire,
profit, love a show,
right? It's gonna have to be a billionaire who really cares and wants to bring a guy like Cristobal home. And I could see Lemonis, because he's a Columbus guy, right? He has the connection with Cristobal and the whole thing.
Yep.
But again, this is his decision whether he wants to do something like that. And again, you know,
right. And does he want to shell out $20-30 million to see the Hurricanes compete for a playoff spot? Like, is that really the investment? What's the ROI on that form? And the reason why a lot of these guys, these board of trustee members, or that quote you just said, are talking about, yeah, the investments go to these specific schools and to fund these certain things, is the funding the football program doesn't give their degree more prestige. It doesn't earn the alumni more money if they go apply for jobs. What does? The school being academically elite does.
Right. And they're more upset right now about being ranked 55th on the U.S. News and World Report, and yep. Florida State being, what, 56 right behind them? Or they're
I can guarantee you, as an attorney, I can guarantee you they're more pissed off about FIU having a higher bar passage rate than they do, than they are about the way the football teams play.
Right. And here's the thing that people have to understand. This isn't anything brand new. Like, this has been going on since before college football started making serious money. Like, go back to the 80s and 90s, right? When Miami, well,
Tad Foote wanted to make it the Harvard of the South, remember?
Right. And just go back to the 80s and 90s, right? I mean, how much did they pay for Jimmy Johnson? How much did they pay for Dennis Erickson? It wasn't like life-changing money for those coaches. Now that everybody's on TV and you have all this TV revenue, other schools are spending a boatload of money. And you know, Miami is still a private school. Look, I'm not saying that Miami doesn't have the money. They could get the money. The whole point is that quote that I just read you. They're not going to spend it on football. That's what you need to get through your head. So if Miami's going to have a success story, okay, it's going to be what Jimmy and Dennis did and Howard, where they came in here, they recruited the shit out of South Florida and Florida. They had really good assistant coaches that were under the radar, that developed players really, really well, and they surprised everybody. That's what happened. Now in this era, you know, the 2000s, 2010s, 2021s, I mean, Miami's continued to sort of hire at the same rate, right? I mean, Larry Coker was an assistant coach. Butch Davis was an assistant coach. You know, Al Golden came from Temple, but it's not like he was some big time coach who'd won a bunch of championships.
Yeah, Randy Shannon was the first time head coach.
Right. And Manny is technically he was a head coach for 17 days at Temple, but he's an assistant. So what does that tell you? That is the history of the last 30 years at the University of Miami. That is just the way that they have operated. And I just for fans who are frustrated, I get it. You want to have this dream that one day this is all going to get fixed. Right. And the perfect coach is going to come here. But I think right at the bat, you got to understand that it's not a priority. They got into the ACC. They used football to get themselves into the ACC to get that big time money. They're happy with that. They already won their Super Bowl, yep, as far as the University of Miami is concerned. So,
and the only big time coach they've ever hired is Mark Richt. And he was coming off and getting booted out by Georgia, and he was exhausted.
And Mark was at the end of his career. He took a discount. Okay. He took a discount.
Listen, and let's not forget, everybody's clamoring for Mark Richt now on Twitter. Everybody that was clamoring for Mark Richt right now wanted his ass fired after his last season here. And we're thanking God that he decided to retire instead of having to pay a buyout.
Again, I'm not trying to, I said it when Manny Diaz was hired. I would have preferred that they went after a head coach with experience. That's what I wanted. I wanted somebody who wouldn't make some of these rookie mistakes that he's made. And I wanted somebody who would just know what buttons to push to get this thing rolling in the right direction after two decades. It's clear that he's learned on the job. He did it his first year with Dan Enos. It took him a year to figure out we need to change the offense. Then, you know, he learned, hey, I got to change the recruiting department. He did that. Hey, I got to, you know, go and use the transfer portal because some of these players aren't very good. He did a good job of that. He's just not winning right now. And I think a big part of that is players letting him down. Will Mallory,
yeah.
Mike Harley. I mean, you could go down the list of guys who have just not played well. And so while it's easy to just say fire Manny Diaz, replacing him with what you want is the harder problem. And
yep.
Again, unless Mario Cristobal comes with a cape to save the day. I mean, I just think the next hire will be the same type of thing. They'll probably to appease the fan base, hire some guy out of the MAC or some guy out of the Sun Belt Conference. And that'll be it. And that'll be the move. It'll be a head coach who won in a average conference who they hope can come in here and turn things around. And again, look,
not easy. Look at Scott Satterfield in Louisville.
Right.
It's not easy.
It's not. And, you know, Manny, for all his flaws that everybody wants to point out, and you know, the one thing you have to give him credit for is he does care. He does. This does matter to him. This isn't like just some BS job. He took this job and he wants to do it the right way. And, you know, I don't see him just throwing his hands up in the air and saying, screw it, we're done for the year. Like, he's not acting like a coach like that at all. He's trying to get things fixed. And I think for the fans, at some point here, you just got to like accept that if there's going to be changes, it's probably not going to happen until the end of the year. And don't set your expectations high. Unless
I think there's a couple things, right? I've been saying for a long time on this podcast that Manny Diaz is the most self-aware coach we've had recently, right? Because Al Golden failed to make a move with D'Onofrio and it cost him his job and it cost him probably a long tenure here in Miami. So we've seen him be self-aware in the offseason. Now it's time to see Manny be self-aware in season. I think he has a good understanding of what the issues are on this team. And I think he has a good understanding of how the fan base feels. And I think moving forward, he should get this feeling that if these guys that I'm counting on are letting me down, then what I need to do is save my own ass by one, making sure I keep my recruiting class and improve it. And two, by building in an excuse for myself. How do you do that? Play all the young guys. Why? Because if you end up 7-5, 8-4, you're like, well, shit, I finished this way because I was playing all freshmen and sophomores or second year freshmen, right? Redshirt freshmen. This is why that happened. But when these guys grow up, they're going to be a lot better. And then you turn around to the recruits and say, did you see how many young guys we played? You sign with us, you're going to get on the field right away. Don't sign with anybody else. You want to wait 3 years to play at Alabama? You want to wait 3 years to play at Texas A&M or Clemson? Come here, play now. All right. So he could give those sales pitches to the fans and to the recruits. The other thing is, I mean, if we sat here before the season, right, before game one, and I told you that the linebackers were going to have issues, yeah, you'd be like, shit, that's understandable. We see that. No problem. The offensive line was going to have issues, even though Kelvin kept saying Zion Nelson was going to be a top 15 pick. And I kept saying, Kelvin, what are you smoking? Okay, that Flacca is not good for you, but he didn't listen, right? We would understand because we knew this offensive line was dog shit. But if I told you that Mike Harley, Mallory, Bubba Bolden, Gervin Hall, well, maybe I believe that, Gervin Hall, and De'Eriq King were all playing subpar and costing you games, you would have been like, you're crazy. That's not going to happen, right?
Right. And that's exactly what's happened. And you know, they've been let down. And I will say this, okay, to defend some of the fans' criticisms of the coaching staff. Where you have to blame the coaches is adjustments. And, you know, you look at the first half, for instance, on Saturday, it's sort of a perfect example for the defense. They were shutting down Michigan State's run, right? The offense wasn't able to do much. Yes, Michigan State had a 10-7 lead, but Kenneth Walker was not just stampeding all over them, certainly not in the middle of the field. So they had the right defensive approach early. But what happened after halftime? What did Michigan State do? We're going to start running screens left and right. We're going to move your guys around. We're going to hit the perimeters, and we know we're going to beat you there. And it's up to Manny Diaz as defensive coordinator at some point to make some level of an adjustment. And I know that's not easy to do in the middle of a game. You know, at halftime, you can talk to the kids, you can make adjustments, but that's an indictment on him. That's an indictment on him as a coach. And we've seen that happen to him before. And Rhett Lashley, the same thing, right? Defenses make adjustments. One thing I'll point out, I've yet to see a defense look surprised at any Miami play call this year, correct or wrong on offense.
No, you're right. And I heard you mention that on the Big O Show today that, you know, last year Lashley schemed up a bunch of touchdowns for this offense, but this year it hasn't happened. And I think it goes back to what you're saying with the over-reliance on De'Eriq King. And also the other thing is they're trying to pull the same rabbit out of the hat that they did last year to sneak up on teams. And these guys have now had a full offseason to watch film of everything you did and prepare and practice. You're not going to catch people off guard. Like, I think it was App State. We tried to run the fake quarterback draw, drop back and hit Mallory in the middle of the field. And that shit was completely covered. And you see App State's coach on the sideline yelling and pumping his fist saying, yeah, we knew that was coming.
Right.
Like, you have to do different things. You have to scheme different things up. And sometimes, you know, necessity is the mother of invention and innovation. Lashley now without De'Eriq King is going to have to strap it on and figure out how he gets points. Because if he doesn't, then we're going to start seeing goose eggs.
Yeah, and the schedule is going to get tougher. Although, according to Pro Football Focus, Miami's remaining schedule is the 33rd easiest in college football, according to your research, correct?
That is, well, according to my Twitter account, yes, that's what PFF tweeted out.
Now I will say ESPN's Power Index predicts Miami to finish 6-6. All right. Here's a couple that we can look at the ACC a little bit in here and discuss some of the opponents. Virginia's offense has looked very, very good. Brennan Armstrong, the quarterback that I was very high on before the season, that people were laughing at me saying you're an idiot, has looked really, really good for them.
That was Kelvin for the most part.
Right. This kid has they scored 39 points. They lost 59-39. Their biggest issues are on defense, which is good for Miami. But yeah. what they also create is issues for you on defense with missed tackles and so forth. So if Brennan Armstrong comes in here and he's a dangerous two-way threat, Miami could very much lose that game. I know we're skipping past Central Connecticut State, but we all know that Miami should win that game, right? And hopefully convincingly, right? And then after that, you've got the 2 weeks off before North Carolina, which is going to be, to me, I mean, I still look at those guys as the favorites to win the division. I know Virginia Tech just lost at West Virginia, and they beat them to start the year. But I still think Sam Howell and Mac Brown, I still think they're the favorites to win. So that's going to be a really tough game for Miami to win. On the road to Pittsburgh, not easy either, even though Pittsburgh just lost to Western Michigan. The other observation, Clemson. I mean, they lose one of their best defensive players. Offensively, they're struggling. I know everybody's looking ahead like, oh, if we can just win the division, this could be the year that Miami beats Clemson. But right now, if I'm a Miami fan, I'm just trying to get past Central Connecticut State healthy and looking better offensively going into that Virginia game, because I think, you know, 6-6, I could see 7-5, maybe even 8-4. But I don't see anything above that the way they're playing right now.
Oh yeah. The way they're playing right now, I think you're looking at 6-6, 7-5. They've got to make improvements across the board. And I think the mentality needs to shift now because everybody came in with all these expectations. I think that's the other thing why everybody's pissed off. It's because they came in with these expectations for this team with all these guys coming back, believing that coming off of last year, they would make another jump and push forward to an 11-1, 10-2 season, be competitive against Alabama, maybe lose to North Carolina, but lose tough and get in the ACC title game. Well, we're not there. And the expectations need to be tempered and changed. Right now, it's NCAA March Madness mode. Survive and advance, right? Every week, it's going to be a dogfight. It's going to be a nail biter. And you have to advance and survive. And to be quite honest, I looked at the schedule, and there's only, let's say, one, two, maybe three games that you could probably say, all right, I feel comfortable. So FSU, even though it's a rivalry game, they look terrible. I think they have a shot there. Duke, they should beat. Even though Georgia Tech gave Clemson all they can handle, Georgia Tech is not very good this year. So that's three games that I think they're okay. Virginia is going to be one hell of a tough game because, like you said, Brennan Armstrong's playing very well, and their offense is very good. If they could score on that defense, which is not very good, then they have a shot. But Virginia is going to do the same thing that App State and Michigan State have done, which is Virginia's calling card against Miami. They're going to go quarters. They're going to play off the ball. They're going to make you grind it out and not try and give up big explosive plays. So where does Miami find those explosive plays? They got to figure it out because even last year, they didn't figure it out. They didn't score a lot of points against Virginia. So let's see what happens. I mean, I think they get demolished by North Carolina. Hopefully not. Hopefully they lose in a shootout. But right now, it's not looking likely. And, you know, NC State, that's another team that's got a pretty good offense. That's another dangerous game. I'm not sure what's going to happen there. I think they can beat Pitt, but I'm not 100% sold. So we'll see, man. I mean, it all depends on what this team does moving forward. How do they correct the issues that they're having? And what are the main issues then that they are having that need to get fixed to be able to have a shot to finish a season 8-4, 9-3? Well, one, tackling, like we talked about. Two, they've got to stop the stupid drive-killing penalties that have killed them the first three games of the season. They've got to have their playmakers make plays and catch the football, and the defensive playmakers make plays. And they've got a run block, man. It's just that simple. It's not a lot of things. It's not like complicated shit. Block, catch, and tackle. And do something. The old Willie Tiger thing. Do something.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yeah, I will say this. I think the tackling is going to get better. And you asked me before we started recording this episode, you said, how bad have Manny Diaz's defense been at missed tackles? Right now, they're averaging 22 missed tackles a game. Since he got here in 2006, I have the totals for you. 9.5 tackles his first season per game, missed 9.5 tackles. They had 6. They had 5 double-digit missed tackle games. The worst was against North Carolina. They had 18 against them and 17 against Virginia Tech, all right? In 2017, they averaged 11.2 missed tackles per game. They had 18 missed tackles against FSU, 14 against Georgia Tech. I mean, they had a lot of double-digit tackle missed games. So even in 17, when they were great, great for their standards, right, 10-3, and in the ACC championship game, they averaged 11 missed tackles a game. In 2018, when they had actually their best defense, they only averaged 88.8 missed tackles a game. So that was the key. Why were they so great on defense? Well, you had Gerald Willis creating a bunch of havoc, and then you weren't missing tackles in the secondary. You had a veteran secondary that wasn't making mistakes. That's not what's happening now. 2019, they averaged 10.1 missed tackles, and that number was badly skewed because they had 30 versus Georgia Tech in that game that they lost where they couldn't kick a field goal, okay? So they had 30 missed tackles against Georgia Tech that year. If not, you take away that game, there were only 3 other games where they had 10 or 11 missed tackles. They were below that. That was Shaq and Pinckney's senior year where they both played. People criticized them, but they weren't missing a lot of tackles. And then last year, 2020, they averaged 10.5 missed tackles per game. Their worst was the 24 missed tackles in the North Carolina route. So you ask me, how is this for, par for the course for these with the way they're tackling? No, they're averaging double the amount that they normally do. If you look at the numbers, they average 9, 10 or 11 missed tackles a season. So it's going to get better. There's going to be a return to the mean in some way. And I think part of it is going to have to be strategy, because somebody messaged me on Twitter asking me today, a question about run blitzes and, you know, how many times are they sort of overrunning the play? When you look at the film, Carlos, what do you see as a former high school quarterback of what they're doing defensively that's killing them?
Well, being a former high school quarterback really doesn't qualify me to say anything regarding any sort of thing, anything schematic. But yeah, what I've seen in the film, the first 3 games, because as you know, I'm a nerd and I'm obsessed and I watch the games over and over again after it happens, is the linebackers are not instinctive, right? Specifically, Corey Flagg is better than Steed, and he's better than Keontre Smith at diagnosing plays. But specifically, Wayman Steed sits there, sees a down block, and when you see a down block, you are supposed to react a certain way as a linebacker. You are supposed to fill that gap, and or if it goes zone away from you, you're supposed to trail and make sure nothing cuts back against you, right? And be the second man in. They're not doing that. They're just sitting there and waiting for things to happen. They're reacting instead of reading the offense and making plays. What was great about Shaq and Pinckney was those guys knew what was happening as soon as they saw it. They would diagnose things quickly and go make plays. Sometimes they get there and miss a tackle. Rarely it happened. The other thing they would do is sometimes go in the wrong gap, but they were constantly making aggressive mistakes. The thing that these linebackers are doing is they're not making aggressive mistakes. They're making mistakes because they're passive. And that comes to a lot of that happens because they don't know what they're doing. I think Corey Flagg does for the most part, but you know, Steed doesn't look like he's comfortable unless, like that Twitter question, he's run blitzing. If you notice, most of the plays that Wayman Steed made were on blitzes and on run blitzes. He never just goes, fills a gap when he diagnoses something. As a matter of fact, he normally just backpedals out there until an offensive lineman hits him or until he says, oh shit, there's the ball. And then he goes to try and get it and it's too late.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's an indictment on Manny and not recruiting the kind of linebackers to get ready to play in those positions. Avery Huff is another example. He finally got a chance to play some in this game, but guys that have to know what they're doing, right, and trust what they're doing and stay where they're supposed to be.
And want to fill the gaps and want to go on there and be physical. And I think the other thing that you're seeing with the defense is beyond that linebacker level, that second level, in the secondary, you are not getting the help and run support that you should be getting. Gervin Hall is not coming up and hitting dudes once they get past the 3 or 4 yard mark past the linebackers. Bubba Bolden comes in there flying like a missile with his head down all the time. And sometimes he makes a tackle. Sometimes he whiffs because he's coming in there without even seeing what the hell he's doing. He just launches himself like a missile and tries to hit everybody in the legs. And the defensive tackles have been inconsistent. You saw Nesta play a great fourth quarter against App State last week and be disruptive. And you saw the difference that made for the defense. But this week, he was nowhere to be found. And to be able to be a good defense, you have to start from the middle backwards. You have to be better at the defensive tackles where they create disruption and make it hard for the offensive lineman to get to the second level and block your linebackers. So your linebackers are free to come in and make plays, and your secondary players are behind that to make sure if somebody misses a tackle, they're there to clean it up. Now, the third thing that they're messing up and they're not doing well is they're getting no pressure from the edges, right? They're only getting to the quarterback sometimes with blitzes. And even then, there are times when you saw against Michigan State, they brought blitzes and Michigan State just, you know, fanned it out, blocked it, and nobody got to the quarterback. And that's happened for 3 weeks. They can't get to the quarterback even on blitzes, and that's a problem. And I think a big change needs to happen in terms of how they get pressure and how they create chaos up front. And, you know, to me, I was reading this on Twitter, and it was surprising to me that, you know, Chance Williams' snaps were cut in half compared to the Alabama game. He's gotten less snaps every game, and I don't understand how, because that kid's the best defensive end we got right now.
Yeah, he's made plays in all three games for Miami, and it's kind of, it is kind of baffling. You'd hope he'd start to get some more work. I guess they feel like Zach McLeod is helping them on run stops, or is maybe the guy who sets the edge the best as far as you know, defensive ends. I'm going to throw out the stats here just because I looked this up for my story. But Miami's leaders in missed tackles this season: Corey Couch, Wayman Steed with 7 each, Gervin Hall, Bubba Bolden, Amari Carter with 6 each. Keontra Smith, who's obviously out, won't be back at least until the North Carolina game at the earliest. Keontra Smith has 4. Corey Flagg, Tyreek Stevenson, and Jordan Miller and Gilbert Frierson and McLeod have 3 missed tackles each. By the way, Juwan Mitchell, the kid that Miami was sort of flirting with from Texas, the one that they wanted to get and ultimately decided to pass on, he's played in 2 games, 10 tackles, 1 missed tackle. So, you know, he's the guy that they could have had that brought in here that would have been the veteran to help out. In the end, Manny Diaz passed on him for whatever reason. He's playing at Tennessee in 2 games. He's got 10 tackles, 1 missed tackle.
And I think Zach McLeod doesn't have more missed tackles because you actually have to be around the ball to miss a tackle. So that might be the problem with the McLeod numbers.
All right. So offensively, we've talked a lot about defense. And, you know, today, Tavarius Robinson defended the honor of Gervin Hall in that ridiculous play, saying, you know, Miami's not soft.
And the funny thing is, when he was doing that, you heard the Peter Cetera song in the background. I am the man who will fight for your honor.
So what I wanted to say here is, defensively, I think the back end, to me, honestly, has been the more frustrating part of all this because of the breakdowns in the secondary. And it just feels like a lot of the mistakes have been made by those guys. And tonight, Inside the U, by the way, reported that it looks like Gervin Hall is going to be benched, that he will be replaced by either James Williams or Cam Kitchens. And according to our insider, Kelvin Harris, it'll be Cam Kitchens who starts because he plays free safety and James plays strong safety, according to Kelvin. So we'll see.
If that's true, then again, this is what I'm talking about with Manny being self-aware and knowing he needs to make moves, because Gervin Hall has been atrocious this season.
Yeah, he has. In terms of missed tackles, no doubt.
He's been shit in coverage too. I mean, that slant that Jaden Reed finally caught at the end of the game, he was staring right at him. Literally, if Gervin Hall just attacks the ball like he's supposed to, he could have maybe had a pick 6 going the other way, but he just lets the guy catch a slant because I don't know what he's looking at. And then the week before against App State, he's not over the top like he's supposed to be, and that deep post that he caught for a touchdown was on him.
Correct. I'm looking at the coverage numbers because those are always good numbers to sort of review. And according to this, Tyreek Stevenson has given up 9 catches, but on 19 targets. Amari Carter, 10 catches on 13 targets, and Gervin Hall, 8 catches on 10 targets. Stevenson beat twice for touchdowns now, although he's got three pass breakups. I think really Tyreek's the only guy who's played halfway decent in the secondary, correct?
He has. And I think that play where he got beat for the touchdown, I think he was exhausted, man.
Yeah.
I think he was the only guy out there really giving effort in that secondary. And at some point he just ran out of gas, got caught on the double move, and was like, oh shit, here it goes.
Right.
What are the numbers on Frierson? Because I'm tired of Amari Carter. He's no fun anymore because he's not getting ejected and I can't make fun of him. Now he plays the whole game and now I'm wishing he gets ejected.
Gilbert Frierson has played as many snaps as Chance Williams, 81 snaps. Carter has played 168. He's fourth on the team in snaps. It's Gervin 1, 210 snaps. Tecori Couch 2, 183 snaps. Tyreek Stevenson 3, 174. And then Carter 168. Bolden next with 162. They've played five guys in the secondary most of the season. Like and Ivory, he's got 86 snaps. He's the worst. He's ranked 103rd out of 106 DBs in the ACC right now, according to PFF. So, I mean, the secondary for all the excitement about T-Rob, right? And hey, they got veteran guys back. It just hasn't panned out well for those guys, unfortunately. Maybe there's a way that they turn it around here. I don't know.
To me, one of the things that's shocking to me is that Frierson's not getting more snaps because I thought he was the most consistent player on defense last year.
Right.
And go ahead.
I was going to say Manny Diaz has said he wanted more physicality at the striker position, which is why Carter is playing.
Well, I mean, physicality compared to what? Because I thought Frierson was pretty physical, but I mean, Amari Carter's out there getting lost in the wash. He had one big play against App State, and after that, he's done absolutely nothing. He's also not very physical coming up because he's afraid to get ejected because he doesn't know how to hit people normally.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's raise this topic up and then we'll wrap up the show here. Do you think taking on the defensive coordinator role has been too much for Manny Diaz to handle? The question was raised this week by my colleague, Kobe Price from the Sun Sentinel. He asked Manny essentially that question. Do you think, you know, Manny has any regrets over taking on double duty?
Listen, I don't think it's too much if you've got the right setup. So Jimbo Fisher has been doing this for years. Other coaches have done it for years. Most prefer to delegate and just be the CEO type. But Manny decided to take this back on, and he was a good defensive coordinator when he was a DC. The thing you need to have in place is you have to have a guy that will help you game plan, because you have to split your time up amongst meetings and make sure everything's running smoothly and have the top end of the program organized. And the other thing you need to do is have that same guy do the corrections on the sideline while you're monitoring the game as a head coach. So if you don't have a guy that's your right-hand man that can help you game plan, help you do the install, and then help make corrections on the sideline, then you're at a disadvantage and then it's not going to work out. So I don't know what system they have going on, but if they don't have somebody that's sitting with these players on the whiteboard as the game is going on and making corrections, then they're going to have a long season because that's critical. You were talking about making adjustments in game. Every time a team comes off the sideline after a series, whether they score or they give up a score or they don't, or they get a stop, they always sit around and talk about what happened on that last series and what the other team is doing and how they can counter that. But if they don't have somebody doing that, then that's a problem.
Yeah, and I don't know that they do. I don't know how much Ed Reed is around. Everybody's like, oh, Ed Reed, he should be fixing all these things. You know, this is not that kind of job for Ed Reed. You know, he's got another life. He is an advisory board member. You know, basically, he chips in his 2 cents when he wants. He's not a coach. He's not there to coach and be that heavily involved. And from the offensive side of things, just we'll wrap up with that really quick. What do you do this week? Especially with De'Eric probably not playing, do you make more of an effort to just establish a running game? That's what I would run the ball 60 times in this game. Yes, you want your quarterbacks to get some work as well, but I really think let's build some confidence up, even if it's Central Connecticut State. Like, let's just block people and move the football.
I mean, I think you give guys opportunities. I think that's the first thing you need to do on offense, right? What if you want to be balanced, if you want to be, you know, heavier on one side or the other, I think Lashley needs to go in there and get this team, like you're saying, some confidence moving forward. And that includes the quarterback. So if you're going to go in there and just hand it off 60 times and let Tyler Van Dyke throw it 10 times, I don't think that's going to work. You need to get that guy ready for the remainder of the season. And you need to do the same thing with Jake Garcia when he gets in there. You got to have these guys throw the ball and make reads as if they were going to be there the rest of the season, having to do that. I think the other thing you need to do moving forward past Central Connecticut State is you need to be more creative in the way you get the ball to your playmakers and get more playmakers in the game. So for one, I was extremely disappointed this past week that Restrepo didn't get more balls thrown his way or get more snaps. I don't know how many snaps he got. It seemed to me like he got less than he did against App State.
He might have. I don't have the exact numbers right in front of me. I'll go ahead. You keep carrying the conversation.
The kid's a playmaker, and every time he touches the ball, he makes a play. Breshard Smith got one carry on that end around. He showed how fast he is. That kid needs more touches because that's an explosive player. When Jalen Knighton comes back, he's going to need touches because he's an explosive player, a difference maker. Rambo needs to keep getting the ball. We need to find ways to get the ball to Keyshawn Smith, either down the field or the same way we're getting it to Rambo. You need to get Elijah Arroyo on the field because that guy has had the ball thrown to him two or three times, and he's actually caught it and made plays with it. So this is what needs to happen. It doesn't need to be overcomplicated. You just need to get these guys the ball in space and let them work, which when you saw what that happened on Saturday with Rambo, it paid off. And then all of a sudden, we forgot how to do it.
By the way, I really think Cody Brown needs to be given a really good look in this game because, first of all, you can't play Cameron Harris 88 snaps like you did in last game. No.
Franklin needs some too.
Yeah, they need some pass protection situations, and they need to be able to get some carries because, by the way, when Jalen Knighton comes back, he hasn't been practicing all this time, right? When you're suspended, you're not allowed to practice. So he's going to have to, you know, and it's a short week. I know everybody's like, oh, he'll be back for Virginia. Yeah, it's not going to be like Jalen Knighton's ready to just go in there and start and you know, carry the offense game one. It's going to take him a while to get back in shape. Avante Williams just got back and is doing things with the team this week that we were able to spot him on the field. So, by the way, Xavier Restrepo, 35 snaps against Michigan State and Alabama, only 16 against App State. So there you go.
Oh, look, there we go.
Yeah, but his targets, I mean, and I get what you're getting at. I mean, he was targeted 5 times against Alabama, twice against App State, once against Michigan State. So there you go.
There needs to be more targets for that kid, especially if Mike Harley is dropping the ball.
Correct. Carlos, I am not going to this week's game. I'm going up to Jacksonville to be with my brother who's here from California, visiting my parents who are up there and my brother. So I got a little family reunion, but I will be watching the game on my computer and following it and filing a story from up there. What are you doing for this weekend? I mean, and how empty is this stadium going to be on Saturday?
Wow. I think it might look like a Marlins game is my thought. So I'm not going to the game. I'll be watching in the comfort of my own home and maybe even starting the game late, which is rare for me because I like to do a pregame tailgate at the house and then watch the game on time. I'll probably be catching it later on the DVR. My hope is that they look good in this game, good enough to gain some confidence going into Virginia, and then fingers crossed, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I agree. I think they cruise. And by the way, this Central Connecticut State team, they've got four guys from Florida, and their quarterback, Romello Williams, went to Miramar High School, 6'1", 185 pounds. So far this season, let me look at his numbers. 581 yards, passing 5 touchdowns. It is a South Florida kid coming home to play. You never know.
Yeah, I mean, and every time a South Florida kid comes to play at Hard Rock, they end up kicking our ass. So hopefully this kid does not do that. I call it the Willie Burton effect. Willie Burton got traded from the Heat, came down and scored 56 on him. He hadn't scored 56 his entire Heat career. And it happens every time to the Hurricanes. I hate to see it.
Right. Well, let's hope they come out healthy and that when we come back next week and talk about Virginia, we hear some positive news. It would suck if De'Aaron King is seriously injured. Again, that's just a rumor that I heard tonight. We'll find out tomorrow morning when Manny Diaz meets with us. I'm sure we'll get some sort of response here. But it'll be interesting times ahead, man. I wouldn't hang your hat on somebody getting fired anytime soon. I don't think that's going to happen. So, Carlos, thanks for everything. Once again, make sure to follow. You want to give him your Twitter address and again, plug the podcast.
Sure. The podcast is the MIA All Day Podcast. And I rarely use the Twitter handle for that unless I'm putting out like a podcast episode, but it's MIA All Day Pod. And my personal Twitter handle, it's Eledo1307, which is ELLEDO1307.
All right, that's going to do it this week. No fancy interviews with anybody famous or anything like that. No other beat writers coming on. Just me and Carlos for you, talking raw Canes football before Central Connecticut State. So that wraps it up. We will see you next week. For Carlos Ledo, I'm Manny Navarro from The Athletic. Make sure you subscribe to TheAthletic.com and follow me on Twitter at Manny_Navarro.
305-954-568. This is the state of Miami. Y'all know y'all come down that way.